Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, January 30th, 2026, we're delighted to host a discussion on school choice and the Federal Tax Credit Scholarship Program, or FTCSP. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's program, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, we will keep our introduction of our guest today brief, certainly more brief than their careers would deserve, so I highly recommend that if you're interested, you check out their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. I'll go ahead and introduce our moderator, and then I'll leave it to him to introduce our panel. Today, we are fortunate to have with us as our moderator, Gene Scher, who is a partner at Scher Jaffe LLP, where he specializes in handling civil appeals, writ proceedings, and similar matters, both in appellate courts and in law-focused proceedings at trial court or the agency level. He's argued and won dozens of cases in a variety of forms, including the U.S. Supreme Court, where he's argued six cases, every federal circuit, and numerous federal district courts and state appellate courts. He also teaches courses in Supreme Court litigation, religious freedom litigation, and advanced litigation skills as an adjunct professor of law at the Brigham Young University Law School. And before forming his own firm in 2014, he was a coordinator at Sidley Austin's appellate practice from 1993 to 2005. And from 2005 until 2014, he was the chair of the nationwide appellate practice at Winston & Strawn. And I'll leave it there. A last note before I get off your screens, if you have any questions throughout the program, please do submit them via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen, so it'll be accessible when we get to that portion of today's webinar. I'll ask that all questions submitted there, A, pertain to this discussion, and B, end with a question mark. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Mr. Scher, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much, Kayla, and it's an honor to be with you and with our esteemed panelists today. This is going to be a series of three relatively short discussions, each of the three discussions led by one of our panelists. And so I'll begin by introducing Leslie Heiner. Leslie is the Vice President of Legal Affairs and Director of the Legal Defense and Education Center at an organization called EdChoice. She's a dedicated attorney and some would even say a crusader for educational freedom. She leads nationwide efforts to defend school choice programs and to empower parents to make the best educational decisions for their children. And drawing on her extensive experience in legal policy and advocacy. And next, I'll introduce Jim Blue. Jim is the co-founder of the Defense of Freedom Institute, and he brings, like Leslie, brings decades of experience in education reform, having served as the Senate-confirmed Assistant Secretary for Planning, Evaluation, and Policy Development at the U.S. Department of Education. And he has led national organizations like Students First and the Alliance for School Choice, and directed over $1 billion in K-12 investments at the Walton Family Foundation, all designed to expand educational opportunities for children. And finally, we have with us Shaka Mitchell, who's the senior fellow at the American Federation for Children. He has a background in leading charter schools networks like the Rocket Ship Education and Lead Public Schools. And he has hands-on experience expanding educational options in various places in the country. He holds a JD from Wake Forest University School of Law. He started his career at the Center for Education Reform and the Institute for Justice, and now teaches constitutional law as an adjunct professor at Belmont University, while continuing to advocate for school choice nationwide. So with that, why don't we turn it over to you, Leslie, to lead a discussion with us about the state of school choice initiatives in the states, apart from the federal legislation that was just recently passed on that subject.
Thank you, Gene. I am delighted to share the good news about school choice, and there's a lot. Right now, this is National School Choice Week. We began National School Choice Week back in 2011 as a way to help people understand what it is, what it does, and what kind of opportunities are available to families and to their children. Currently today, there are 75 school choice programs in 34 states, plus in DC and also in Puerto Rico. Now, to give you a little sense of perspective, I first began advocating for school choice exactly 40 years ago.
Oh, wow. And sorry, Leslie. It was a long time.
Yes, this is my 40th anniversary. And at that time, I began because I had a lawsuit. I was a young practicing attorney, and it was perhaps the first school choice litigation in the state of Indiana, where the simple question was, who is the proper person or entity to decide where and how a child should be educated? Who decides? I won, so that was great. But I left that case just deeply disturbed about the state of education in the country. At that time, there was a little tax credit in the state of Minnesota, a few hundred dollars for a parent who spent their own money on education. And there were two other town-based voucher programs in Vermont and also in Maine that had been established in 1869 in Vermont, 1873 in Maine. Nothing else was happening 40 years ago. There were no charter schools. There were no school choice programs at all. The idea of transferring from one public school district to another was not something anyone talked about. That was the state of education. And now, just 40 years later, we have so much innovation in education that, frankly, for those of us who are working in this area, it's pretty tough to catch up. Now, why has this happened? I think very simply, this has happened because parents want it. So at EdChoice, we do a considerable amount of survey work and polling. And there's one question that we have asked consistently over several years, which is simply this. As a parent, if you had a complete choice of where to send your child to school, there were no barriers whatsoever, financial, transportation, where would you send your child to school? And the answer has been consistent year after year. 32% of parents would choose to send their children to a public school. 33% would choose a private school. 12% would choose a public school, but not the one where the child is assigned. 12% would choose homeschooling. And 11% would choose a charter school. Now, today, 80% of students are attending public schools. You can see just immediately that what's happening is not yet matching what parents want for their children, but we're getting closer. That 80% number used to be over 90%, and now it isn't. So parents are without question driving school choice across the country. So what do we have? We have five states that are universal. These states provide every child in the state full funding and full options to what we consider to be, or what are, the 15 most normally requested educational options for children. So those five states, truly universal, they get kudos today. Arizona, Arkansas, Florida, New Hampshire, and West Virginia. Florida wins the title as the biggest school choice state in the country, but they have a lot of competition. Arizona is chomping on their heels, and we consistently find New Hampshire coming up with all kinds of new ideas. It's really pretty impressive. There are 19 states that offer universal eligibility. That means every child has this option for school choice funding. There are 18 states that have universal options. So maybe not all the children qualify, but they can qualify for all the educational needs. and 19 states have universal funding, which means, again, maybe not all the children qualify yet, but the funding is significant and it is solid. So we then have ESAs. Education savings accounts, which allows a parent to choose from a wide variety of educational opportunities for their children. In 18 states, there are 21 programs. There are ESAs that are funded through tax credits. Those exist in 4 states with 4 programs. The vouchers, which is funding very specifically to send a child to pay for tuition, to send a child to a private school. Those are in 13 states, plus DC and Puerto Rico, with 23 different programs. Tax credit scholarships, which are very similar to the federal tax credit that we will talk about soon, exist in 17 states with 21 programs. There are 5 states that have refundable tax credits, 5 programs, and that little education tax credit that I told you about that existed in Minnesota back 40 years ago, it's still there, along with 6 other states that have joined Minnesota in that. There are a total of 8 programs. So you can see that there is quite a lot to celebrate about National School Choice Week. And perhaps the greatest thing that we should celebrate is the awareness of parents as they have come to understand that, first of all, they're understanding what their children are or are not learning in schools. They are understanding when their children come home from school and they haven't learned anything. And they also are understanding that, yes, in fact, as parents, they have both the natural and constitutional right to direct the education of their children. I would be remiss if I didn't mention Pierce versus Society of Sisters, a U.S. Supreme Court ruling in 1925, just a little over 100 years ago, still good law, that declares very firmly that no child in this country is obligated to be educated in a public school. That right to choose belongs to the parents.
Great. Well, let me ask Jim and Chuck if you have anything that you would like to add to what Leslie has told us about that that landscape in the states.
Chuck, why don't you talk about Texas, if nothing else?
Yeah.
Sure. And thanks, Leslie, for setting that up. Just to give folks a sense for the scale of what these school choice, or sometimes referred to as education freedom programs, are now doing for students, I'm going to show just a very brief slide, and hopefully this works. But this is the number of students, student growth and student enrollment in private choice programs just this century. So as Leslie mentioned, we saw the first private choice program in Milwaukee now just over 25 years ago. But we've really seen tremendous growth to where now across the country, these programs are serving more than 1.25 million children every year. Now, as we know, although we're here to talk about the federal tax credit scholarships, most of the action in education is at the state level. And so that's where most litigation is. That's where most of the funding comes from. And that's really where the decision makers are. And so as Jim mentioned, just this past year, I guess in 2025, after decades of advocacy work at the grassroots level and at the General Assembly, the state of Texas passed what will be the largest first day private choice program in history. The applications open, I think, just in a matter of weeks. I believe that's right. And this program will commit $1 billion to scholarships for students that they can use to really customize the education that best meets their needs. And I would just to add a quick point to what Leslie said, you know, I think that we have seen that this movement has won in the court of law for years. We saw this in Zeldin more than 25 years ago. With the more recent court, you've seen in cases like Trinity Lutheran that has really helped Espinosa that came out of Montana. We've seen a whole string of cases.
Of our listeners, would you just briefly describe what those three cases involved?
Sure, I'll try to do it briefly, and Leslie can jump in too, and you as well, Gene. But you know, Zeldin was a really critical case, and this is a case that came Zeldin v. Simmons Harris. It came out of Ohio, and essentially, every time a private choice program is passed, there are litigants who, for one reason or another, say that it offends either the state or the federal constitution. And in Zeldin, they made the claim that the program was unconstitutional because it was directing government funds to religious entities. And the court really helpfully, and I think rightly, said that actually, no, that's not what these programs do. These programs allow parents to direct funds to the educational setting and, you know, provider that makes sense, that aligns with their values, right? And so it wasn't money going to advocate for Catholic schools or Jewish schools, et cetera. This is money funding families and allowing them to make their choice. And so the court sided with us. In Trinity, that was another case came out of Missouri, where there was a grant program that was being denied use when the use was going to when the use would be by a religious organization. And in that case, it was a state grant program. And the court said that's discriminating, right? And you can't discriminate based on that, based on that religious status. Espinosa, and then Leslie, because of course where the bright lights are on, what's the case out of New Hampshire that I'm forgetting? Yes, that's right. Espinosa and Macon. Yep.
And that was out of Maine. Carson versus Macon. Yes.
Yeah, that's right. These are more cases, Gene, that are dealt with some, you know, nuanced issues also about whether or not a state agency could limit how families use money, especially when what they want to do is use that money at a religious or private institution. And I would say we're very fortunate that school choice advocates on behalf of parents, usually intervening on their behalf, have won these cases. But now what we're really seeing is that this momentum is carried over into state legislatures. And so you're seeing this wave of programs that have passed at the state level. So it's really an exciting time.
Chuck, if I could just pause for a minute, as I understand those cases that you discussed, the ultimate message of those cases is that states cannot discriminate against religious schools in school choice programs, either on the basis of their religious status or, in the case of Carson versus Macon, based on their use of those funds to assist them in achieving even, you know, religious objectives, teaching religion. The court has held that the mere fact that a school engages in rigorous teaching of religious precepts can't disqualify them from participating in a school choice program.
That's exactly right. And it's a slightly different construction than what many folks on the call may remember if we were educated under sort of lemon tests and such, and thinking about the, you know, sort of entanglement between the government and religious institutions. So it's a different analysis, but I think a right analysis.
Okay. So you would say all the juice has been squeezed out of lemon.
Absolutely. Thankfully.
Jim, anything to add to that?
No, I think they covered it well.
Should we move on to the new federal opportunity?
Yeah, and I'm happy to start this discussion. I was also going to note that it is National School Choice Week, and they started that. They and it's a group out of Arizona that began it in 2011, and there really weren't that many school options back then. And now we're in a place where, as Leslie and Chuck have already explained, it's becoming common. This week, one of the many things that happened was testimony before the Senate Help Committee, where sort of the architect of the Florida program pointed out that now a majority of students in Florida are not choosing their zoned public school, but are rather choosing other options. It sort of redefines what we mean by public education. So all worth noting. I say all that, and you ain't seen nothing yet, because the federal scholarship tax credit will just about double the amount of money that is being spent on school choice options. I do want to pause here. That does not only mean private school choice options. The law, the federal scholarship tax credit, also includes scholarships for public school students who need a little extra help, for example, a tutoring scholarship or extra services for special education. So this program is a little different. It is not only about private school choice. It also includes charter schools, magnet schools, micro schools, homeschools, you name it. Children will be able to benefit from this. Because I've suffered through a lot of descriptions of this program this week that were completely wrong, I want to take a moment to explain what's actually happening with this scholarship program. Beginning in 27, individual taxpayers will be able to contribute what are called scholarship granting organizations. They already exist all over the country. We imagine this law will encourage the creation of many more. These are tax-exempt charities. They already get donations for creating scholarship programs. What this law does, though, is it moves people who were giving tax-exempt donations to a category where they're going to get a tax-credited donation, a one-for-one credit, up to $1,700 per taxpayer. And that means that we have the potential of raising, well, theoretically, there are about 100 million taxpayers in this country that have that $1,700 worth of liability. So we could raise $170 billion. No one thinks we're going to do that. Randy Weingarten, the head of the AFT, claims we're going to raise $50 billion. I don't know. That sounds like a good goal. But more realistically, we will probably be in the $5 billion, $6 billion range. In the first.
Jim, I wonder if we could pause there for a minute, and could you back up just a little bit and tell us where this law comes from, how it came about?
Yeah. And look, I want to make sure everybody understands that there's tax credits that go to the SGO. The SGO then creates the scholarships. That's where the scholarship programs are.
Right.
There is not a scholarship program at the federal government.
Yeah. And the SGO is just means scholarship granting organization.
Right. They're the intermediary in this whole process. It's important to understand the history. So let me take a moment to do that. It's important to understand because that helps people appreciate where we are today with the Treasury rulemaking, which we'll get into. So there was a period of time before Trump was elected in 2016 where several senators put forward these tax credit scholarship proposals. And as Leslie mentioned, they were all based on state programs. They saw that it was working in the states. They thought they should move it forward. You know, Marco Rubio is one of the major advocates of that. Ted Cruz was another. What is, things changed in 2016. And among other things, Betsy DeVos, who was my boss at the Department of Education, came into office. And this was her highest priority, to get a tax credit program passed. That bill was called the Education Freedom Scholarship. We did not succeed in getting that across the line. It's important for people to understand this is always a long-term process. Everything we've... Shaka mentioned that it took us 20 years in Texas to finally get a bill passed. It takes a while, and it takes constant work helping people appreciate the opportunity here. Then, of course, Biden was elected, and we went into the Biden years. Here, Betsy gets a lot of notice for what she's done in this space. There's a guy who's not very well known. His name is Tony DeNicola, and he deserves a lot of credit. A lot of gratitude for what he accomplished during the Biden years, because he continued to push the scholarship tax credit. He also made some other innovations that are really worth noting. Betsy's program was a opt-out program. Governors were allocated the tax credit funds, and they could then choose SGOs, design their own programs. Tony and his team, which is called Invest in Education, wanted to leave the governors out of it entirely. That may be because he's based in New York State, and he was worried that New York might never opt into a program like this or would immediately opt out. Yeah. So there it was. This was a sort of the pure idea where it's between a donor, the recipient scholarship, and this intermediary C3 that would have been run by or regulated by the IRS. The last chapter, the fourth chapter in this short history, it was about a day long, and it was when the parliamentarian took the bill that Tony and his team had been working on for so many years and decided that it didn't pass the Byrd test, too much program in it. And so she decided to put on top of the existing bill a governor's opt-in. Essentially, children in these states will not get scholarships unless a governor says kids in my state are allowed to get scholarships. That's sort of offensive to those of us who believe that education is between a family, a parent, and their child. But nonetheless, that was her view, that this is something that the state has, you know, these children are a creature of the state, and the state has to decide whether they're going to benefit from this. That may be challenged someday, but right now we're living with it. So this is the law we're dealing with today, where governors decide if they're going to allow children in their state to get scholarships. People will give contributions to SGOs that have been put on a list by a governor, and then those scholarships should start flowing early in 2027. We're all ramping up to be ready for that. So let me pause. Shaka, unless you want to add anything to that?
And that was part of the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill, right? That was...
Yeah, I guess we're now calling it the Working Families Tax Cut Act. But yes, it was Section 25F of that, of the IRS code. Uh-huh. That's...
I think it's also important to state that at every juncture along the way, even beginning with Marco Rubio in 2013 and Cruz after that, at every step along the way, there was a very clear intention for two things. The one is, as Jim has mentioned, that this is for students, that this is a parental choice matter, and the tax credit is something that merely incentivizes donors to contribute to the system where parents can choose and SGOs can provide funding to those parents who need a different choice for their children. That has been the consistent grounding right from the start, with a clear recognition that under our U.S. Constitution, you won't find anything about education, but you will in every state constitution. Education is very much a state matter, and nothing about this federal tax credit should obviate that in any way. And so the intent of the senators who were working on this for all these years was very clear. They could see what was happening in states with all these many tax credit scholarship programs that were working just beautifully in all the states. And yes, there was plenty of litigation. And yes, we won all of that litigation time after time. And so this federal tax credit was always intended to be something that would add to the existing efforts in states and to allow a state like Colorado, I'll use Colorado as an example, that does not have school choice, to have school choice by participating in this federal scholarship tax credit program.
Well, Shaka, anything to add to that history?
Well, I think that Jim and Leslie certainly covered the history well. I don't know, maybe it's worth restating a little bit of the program specifics, or the tax credit specifics, because when Jim mentions that he has heard lots of things that are incorrect, it's probably within this realm. And to no one's surprise, when something is a federal tax credit, for a lot of us, I think immediately we turn the volume down and we go find, you know, dishes to wash or laundry to fold or something like that. But this is really worth paying attention to. So, you know, at the heart, this is a sort of multi-pronged transaction, but it provides the opportunity for taxpayers to direct $1,700 to scholarship granting organizations. Scholarship granting organizations that are designated 501c3 nonprofit organizations, right? So these are independent of state and federal and local governments. They're nonprofits. So you can, if you have that tax liability, you can put it there. Instead of sending it to the federal government, you can put it into a scholarship granting organization. And then those organizations or SGOs make determinations about how they're going to give scholarships. And under the law, there are lots of permissible uses once a family receives one of those, right? So I have school-aged children myself, and I'm also a taxpayer. So I could direct money into a scholarship granting organization, right? Now, I couldn't earmark it for my own children. That's clear in the law as well for folks worried about that. But I could also apply to a different scholarship organization if I wanted to and try to receive scholarships for my own children, right? And then apply those in a manner consistent with the law. Gene, would it be helpful if I showed some of the states that have currently, that have already made a decision to opt in and participate in the program?
Yeah, I think that's the topic we want to get to next, is how do we move from where we are now to getting as many states as possible to opt in? So please.
Great. So I'm going to share this this map. Here is a map of existing state decisions on opting in. Now, mind you, this program really goes into effect in 2027, though. Comments have already been submitted to U.S. Treasury. It will be going through the rulemaking process this spring, hopefully sooner than later. But per the statute, the way that a state says that it can participate, it says that the election under this paragraph shall be made by the governor of the state or by such other individual, agency, or entity as is designated under state law to make such elections on behalf of the state with respect to federal tax benefits. So I will leave it to all the other lawyers who are listening to this webinar to figure out what that means for their particular state. Who makes those elections? Far be it from me to say. In my state, for instance, in Tennessee, our governor has made clear that we intend to participate and that we'll be, you know, taking part in this. But you can see just to our north, in Kentucky, no such decision has been made. Now, I would say that's pretty wrongheaded. If you are the state of Kentucky, what you've got to be thinking about now is, well, taxpayers in the bluegrass state are able to direct their money into a scholarship granting organization. But until one of these decision makers opts into the program, it means that Kentucky taxpayers will be directing money into scholarship organizations in other states that are benefiting other students. That seems like a pretty crazy thing to do. Wouldn't you want all those resources benefiting students in your own state? And so I think that's what governors are really wrestling with right now is, you know, if you are a governor who has thus far been pretty hostile, say, to President Trump's agenda, you may have some impulse to resist on the other hand, you see that this would be a tremendous benefit for kids in your state. And so that's the that is some of what they're wrestling with right now.
Okay, good. Thank you for that. So for the rest of the panel, what are the prospects for making that map more green? Is there any hope that California can be persuaded to join, or that Washington could be persuaded to join? It looks like there are several relatively red states that are at least considering joining. Right.
Let me opine on this. First of all, I don't want to speak for any of the governors, but there is a pattern in the map that you were looking at. There are 26 governors who have opted in to the program. They are all Republicans. And this is due partly to the process that Treasury created, where you're allowed to do an advance election to opt in for 27. And that's so people can begin ramping up and be prepared.
Yeah.
I believe that every state should opt in and will opt in. They may not do it by the January 1st deadline for 27, but they will soon after, because the dynamics that were already alluded to. You're literally, this has no impact on your state budget, because it involves federal income tax. And you're losing the opportunity to serve your public school, charter school, private school families in the state. And then finally, as Shaka pointed out, you're literally allowing money to flow out of your state to help other states. And so that's a pretty untenable situation politically. And I think all governors will realize that and eventually get involved in the program.
You're saying if they reject the program, if they deny approval, then the effect of that is that money is going from their state, from taxpayers in their state, to other states to support school choice in those other states.
Exactly. So I think now I'm generally seen as an optimistic guy. You can't stay in this work for three decades, but I actually don't see any reason why I would be wrong. And we're already seeing some governors who have recognized this. They may not have sent in their form, but Jared Polis out of Colorado, for example, has already said, I'd be nuts not to get involved in this program. So
yeah, Colorado is blue on the map, or is green on the map, right?
Yes. And I think it's because he's made the public announcement, but he hasn't sent in his form. So there is, for everyone, a very open question about how the Treasury rulemaking will turn out. And that is the key.
And tell us what is there for Treasury to decide here? What do they have to do?
Yeah. So, and I want to be fair to Treasury here. this bill was written in the middle of the night, right? A very, very busy time with the one big, beautiful bill and 1,000 things going on. And they had to
accommodate. Frankly, Jim, it was written in the middle of my vacation. Yeah, which was a little frustrating too.
I believe me, I understand. It was 4th of July week. So let's just say the legislative language is not as precise as we might want it to be. And Treasury is now in a position where they have to interpret a law that sometimes, well, it was put together at the last minute. Considering that, it's a very well done law. They were building on 8 years of history, but because of the last minute changes. If you'd indulge me, let me put up a couple of slides about some of the issues that are, let me see, can everybody see that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So we talked a little bit about the governor's opt-in already, and here's the language in there. And that is that, by January 1st, the state has to voluntarily elect to participate, and then they have to give the secretary, that's the Secretary of Treasury, a list of the scholarship granting organizations. If you think about it, this raises all sorts of questions about how much control a governor would have to dictate which SGOs are on the list. Well, it turns out the way that we're interpreting it, and the Treasury has already signaled that they're also interpreting it, that means that the governor has largely a ministerial role. They have a very active role deciding whether children can get the scholarships in their state. But once that decision has been made, anyone who qualifies to be an SGO is put on the Treasury list, and anyone on the Treasury list can receive scholarships to serve students in that state. But I want to just acknowledge that there is a large group of the status quo out there who do not want to see choice or competition in the schools. And they are pointing to this language and saying that's not correct, that the governor should determine who exactly in their state qualifies or not. And that just opens up the whole program to a level of politicking that we don't think serves students at all. We know that many of them are hostile to religious schools, for example, and it would be a shame if you could be in a state where you thought you were getting choice, and now one of the major choices is taken away from you.
Simply because the governor won't approve an SGO that provides scholarships to religious schools. Is that it?
Yeah, exactly. Let me give you another issue. There is a law, there's part of a law, you'll see it here under Section D there, where the organization has to spend at least 90% of the income of the organization on scholarships for eligible students. That sounds fine. And in fact, we don't want a lot of this money going to cover non-scholarship costs. But any 501c3 can participate in this program, including state-based programs that are already receiving scholarship tax credits. And this language, if misinterpreted, would essentially require that every dollar that flows into the Boys and Girls Club or, Future Farmers of America or wherever, all these people that are thinking about using this as a mechanism to provide scholarships, they would have to completely change their organizations in order to accommodate this language. We don't believe that's the right interpretation. We believe this needs to be interpreted in the context of the bill, where it's implied it's 90% of the income from qualified scholarship or qualified contributions, meaning contributions under 25F.
And Jim, if I might jump in here also, this issue, you're just so right, this is really critical, but I find it quite interesting that this issue affects not only those SGOs existing that are currently serving kids who want to have independent education services or have money for tuition at a private school. This also impacts those public school foundations who also want to participate in this program. I did a little research into these public school foundations and discovered that many of them are put together by parent volunteers, and many of them provide scholarships directly to students. It's not all about just raising money for a public school, but they also provide scholarships to public school students, for example, for tutoring or for other educational resources that the public school is not otherwise providing. These public school foundations do that. But the money that they take in money and contributions that is used for those public schools directly, and money that is used that goes directly to a student. So that part is fine, but this 90% of income rule, that's not a rule yet, but they're working on it. But this issue is important equally in the private sector as well as in the public sector. And so those states with governors who are reluctant to say that they're going to join on, most of them are Democrat governors who owe a lot of their political funding to the teachers unions, so they have a reason to hesitate. They also need to come down on our side of this issue, that if I'm giving money to a scholarship granting organization to fund these very open scholarship opportunities under the new federal tax credit, that is the money, 90% of which should go for those, that should go for those scholarships. Money that comes in for any other reasons should go to continue on the other activities, charitable activities of those nonprofits.
Yeah. And look, let's at this point out to everybody that there's an obvious workaround here where interested parties could set up a whole new C3 and start from scratch. First of all, that's quite an administrative burden on organizations that are just trying to serve kids. Any of you who are involved in nonprofits, you understand all the requirements placed on even getting your C3 status and then maintaining it with, you know, being audited and providing financial 990s, et cetera. So to us, it's just unnecessary burden on the field. And it's certainly an unnecessary burden that IRS is putting on itself. There will be hundreds, if not thousands, of SGOs we're hoping who will be applying. And it's just needless, right? We can interpret this part of the law as we believe it was intended. And part of the clue around this is that if you interpret this law incorrectly, it moots out a lot of the other provisions in the law. And that's like basic 101. You shouldn't interpret a law to exclude the rest of the law, right? Shaki, so you want to comment on this or go ahead? I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to mention one thing that may be a concern, not necessarily a regulatory concern or anything brought up by the specific language of the new law, but it's certainly a concern. I think I saw something to this effect in the chat, but for those of us who maybe have been involved with independent education, that is non-public education, maybe you're part of the homeschool community, maybe you're on the board of a private school, et cetera. Folks may wonder and worry, well, are there implications that a school may have to change its mission or maybe otherwise affected by this program due to federal regulations, et cetera. And so I want to make it really clear to note that this is not part of the U.S. Department of Education. This is a tax credit. And so really there's kind of two relationships. One would be between a taxpayer and a scholarship granting organization. And then the next link is between a scholarship granting organization and a family. Right. And then a family decides what is my use case for this scholarship? And so it's already the case that non-public schools in the United States are by law cannot discriminate based on color, national origin, and religion. What am I forget? Leslie, yes?
Go ahead, Leslie.
Okay. So now that's another
nationality.
Part.
Nationality.
That's it. Thank there you.
Oh, you're talking about Title VI. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's already the case, but you know, beyond that, I just wanted to make it clear, Gene, that this is not something that, that has, that brings with it additional strings, with regard to a family's educational experience. And that's really important to know.
Good. Mm-hmm. So back to Jim, has the Treasury launched some kind of a rulemaking process to to resolve these issues that you mentioned?
Yeah, and they've been expeditious about it. It's, we believe rules should be in place this summer so that the SGO list can be developed and people have a chance to ramp up activities. We're told it probably will take people 6 months to do this right. Remember, they have to not only create a system and design scholarships, but they have to raise money in $1,700 increments. And that all of that takes effort. You also need to know who your education providers are. So there's a lot of work to do. Where they are in the process, they've done what's called an advance notice of proposed rulemaking. And, they like Shaka mentioned, they ruined our July 4th. They also ruined our Christmas. This was due on Boxing Day, the day after Christmas. And they got about 3,000 mostly sophisticated comments addressing the kinds of issues that I'm talking about. They also got a couple of thousand comments from, it appears the teacher union gave a template to their advocates and they sent it in, but they don't address any of the core issues. So they have some, they still have about 1,000 comments that they have to absorb and then use those to create an NPRM, a notice of proposed rulemaking. We're hoping that is out by early April.
And then there will be an opportunity to comment again, right?
Yes. And they'll probably have a 30-day or a 60-day formal comment period. And by law, they then have to document their response to every one of those requests. Anyone on the call who's interested in that, please contact any of the three of us separately. Right. We want to encourage a lot of good, sophisticated comments.
Yeah. Do you anticipate that that process will be complete in time for implementation in early 2027? Does it look like they're on track?
Oh, well, yes. Look, the default was that they weren't going to get it done until December of 26. We believe it has to be done this summer, hopefully in June. Look like they're working hard enough to do that.
Good.
We shouldn't discount. There will be litigation. Whatever rule they do, we have very well financed opponents who do not want to see choice and competition in this country. And so they will sue on something. We have no idea what it will be, but we think we're well situated. We don't think there'll be any injunctions and we'll be executing this program January 1st.
Okay, good. Thank you. Well, and on that happy note, why don't we turn to Shaka to talk about other litigation in the school choice area that's going on around the country. And I guess we've got about five more minutes.
Sure. And I'll be brief, Gene. As Jim mentioned, there are always things percolating in court. That is a little bit the nature of our litigious culture, I think. And so people are always welcome to bring cases. There are some ongoing cases, and in some ways, and Leslie can speak to this as well. She's got more experience in this, but we're seeing a lot of the arguments, I would say, sort of have their almost a it's like a remake. You know, we see these movies that are getting remade, like Ghostbusters is a 20-year-old movie, and then all of a sudden someone rediscovers it and dusts it off again and says, let's do that again.
Yeah.
We're seeing some of the similar arguments made again. So in Tennessee, for instance, you've got folks in Tennessee once again claiming that the state constitution that requires that the state legislature provide for, you know, a thorough and efficient system of education. You have folks saying that phrases like thorough and efficient, that really marks a ceiling, and that it must, that's all a state legislature can do, and that it can't do anything beyond providing a single system of public, government run schools. We just saw that argument made in Idaho just 2 weeks ago. I thought that our side did a fantastic job there of explaining why state constitutional language like that is not a ceiling, that it's really a floor. And of course, a state legislature can go over and above that when it's trying to come up with, you know, educational, education programs and provisions for its students. So we continue to see some of that kind of rear its ugly head again. You're also seeing some litigation trying to get around the line of cases that we mentioned earlier, the Carson v. Macon and Espinosa and Trinity Lutheran line of cases, by not attacking religion or religious use or practices head on, but instead by doing things, and Maine is one of these, saying things like, well, schools have to agree that they will sign on to various other pledges or provisions that would really make it untenable for lots of religions and places of worship to sign on to. So they might say, well, you've got to sign on to the UN Declaration of Human Rights if you want to participate in this program. Well, that's not overtly religious, of course, but it does come into conflict with a statement of faith, say, from a church or a synagogue or mosque, et cetera. So we continue to see litigation. I have every expectation that that will persist, but there are lots of great folks around the country, many of whom are Federalist Society members who are actively engaged in fighting those back.
Okay, what would the rest of you like to add?
Yeah, I would add to that that currently there are 11 cases against school choice programs pending in 9 states. However, historically, and I think this is really important, prior to this, there were 53 direct challenges to school choice cases in 25 states. And of all those challenges, that left only 2 states without school choice today. Those 2 states are Colorado and Kentucky. And now we're seeing that Colorado is going to have school choice through this new federal tax credit program. So good for them. And Kentucky will find their way as well. So the track record is without question on our side. Not to mention the fact the U.S. Supreme Court weighed in on tax credit scholarships in 2013 and in an Arizona case versus Wynn. And in that case, a decision written by Justice Kennedy, one of the best decisions I think I've ever read from the Supreme Court, he very clearly stated that there is no litigation. There is no foul here. No harm, no foul. Constitutionally, it's sound. End of story. So even if there is litigation that follows, I'm not too worried about it. We'll fight like we always do, but the odds are definitely in our favor.
Yeah. Thank you. Kayla, if we have time just to maybe answer a question from the chat, and then maybe we can wrap up. And thanks to all of you who have sent in questions. We will try to answer them individually if we don't answer it here. But one question of interest, especially to Leslie, is, Indiana has been a good school choice state for some time. And what do you see as being next for Indiana and states that are already well along on the school choice path?
Oh, I'm happy to share some news on this. Just this week at the Indiana's National School Choice Week event, there were some people who came to speak with and tell us about their innovative ideas. So, for example, there is a public school district not far from Indianapolis that decided that, well, in light of all the school choice that's going around and what parents are telling them, then maybe they need to meet some additional needs of parents that they can't meet in their traditional public school framework. And so they started their own charter school. Wow. And their own charter school is very specifically to meet different needs. So kids who may need to be educated at home, they can do that. Maybe they come into school for a class or two, but the rest is home. That's whatever it is. They have opened this up to all of the possible innovations and activities. Now, when they first did this, there were a handful of kids. And now they're looking at over 600. And they are expanding this opportunity as they're considering now that they should base some of the operations for these charter schools, say, next to a business where they need then for kids then to be trained in certain particular ways, or maybe there's a sharper emphasis on mathematics, et cetera. They could do this in a variety of innovative ways. Microschooling is also thriving across the country, including Indiana. A microschool will start, and it's the same idea. Parent starts at school, maybe a few parents. They get together. They may start with 12 kids. They may hire a teacher to give instruction to kids maybe one day a week or help them planning curriculum. And these schools are doubling, tripling, quadrupling in size so quickly, it's hard to keep up with it. And the good news is that these are kids who were not learning, and now they are. Hmm.
So is it fair to say that that everybody on this panel thinks the future of school choice is bright in this country?
Yes.
Is that the takeaway?
Yes, and it will still be a struggle.
It will be a struggle. Okay.
As bright as my National School Choice Week scarf. Okay. Yes.
That sounds like a good balanced message to end on. Yes. Thanks to all of you for being part of this discussion. Kayla?
I'll jump in and echo those thanks. Really appreciate you all joining us today and sharing your expertise and insight. We appreciate you taking the section of a Friday and being willing to spend it with us. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.